Welcome, everybody. This is the office hours session for what is week 5 of the Mises Academy online class, Introduction to the Free Market. And the only snag is because of my traveling, I got stuck on a runway for 2 hours in Little Rock. And so we haven't actually been able to post the lecture for this week, but I didn't want to get all screwed up. So we're still having the office hours session. So I will send out an email blast. I'm just going to do it on YouTube, and so I'll record the lecture and put it up in, like, I don't know, 4 15-minute blocks or 4 20-minute blocks, something like that, and then send those to you guys so you can watch them on YouTube. So the one upside of it all is that the video is higher quality than it would be if we did it this way. Okay, for this office hours, you guys who are logged in, just go ahead and start firing off questions. As always, it's better for you to ask something than nothing. Why don't I start on something, and then, but for those of you who are logged in, by all means, please type something in here so I can start answering your specific questions. But let me talk a little bit. The big thing that came out recently, or one of the big things, is that the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, announced that in its analysis of the Affordable Care Act, or what's called the ACA, or more colloquially, Obamacare, saying that that's going to, the way a lot of people reported it, in a very brief summary, was to say, oh, the CBO said that Obamacare will cost 2 million jobs, or will destroy 2 million jobs. And so let me just talk a few minutes about what all the issues are on this subject. So first of all, it's a little bit misleading to say it like that, because that would lead the listener to believe that the CBO is saying, because Obamacare is putting all these restrictions on private business, telling them they have to provide all kinds of health insurance benefits for their employees, that the businesses just look at the numbers and say, this is crazy, we're not going to hire people, we're going to lay people off, whatever. There's also the issue of the ACA's employer mandate only applies to full-time employees. And it defines that as being those working 30 or more hours per week. And so if a business has some employee that maybe occasionally works 33 hours, 32 hours, 31, something like that, if the employer just limits that employee now to only working at least on average 29 hours per week, that makes a big difference on the margin. It actually could be anywhere from $2,000 to $3,000 per year for that one worker. Or the cost of health insurance, because the fine is, if I'm remembering off the top of my head right, it's between $2,000 and $3,000, depending on the specifics. Okay, so that's all true, and so you would think, yeah, other things equal, surely if the government comes along and says, hey, if you have someone who works 30 or more hours a week, and you don't give that person health insurance, which could be really expensive now, because they've beefed up what it is, then you have to pay a fine to the federal government, let's say $3,000. But if the person only works 29 hours a week, then you don't have to pay any fine. Well, you might think that would lead to a lot of workers having their hours reduced, even though they wanted to work more. Okay, so that's certainly true, but in the analysis of what's going on, that's not the main thing driving the CBO results. When it says that Obamacare will, in its estimates, reduce employment by 2 million. One thing before I get too deep into it is the hours worked, or sorry, the unit of measurement that they're calling it 2 million full-time equivalent jobs. And what that means is their model doesn't show how many people aren't working who otherwise would have had a job. Rather, it's looking at the aggregate number of hours worked. Because in a lot of cases, some people, it's sort of the opposite of the effect I just talked about. That some people, if they can only get health care by being a full-time employee for a business, will work full-time to qualify. But now that Obamacare has made it easier for everyone to get health insurance, not through their employer, but just to sign up through the government websites, you know, on either the state-based exchanges or healthcare.gov, now there are a lot of people who are saying, oh, you know what, I actually don't want to be a full-time worker. You know, maybe we have young kids at home and I'd rather spend more time with them, or maybe my spouse is the breadwinner and I will just kind of bring in some extra income, but we don't really need it that much. It's mostly just for me to get health insurance. So now that I can get health insurance because of Obamacare, separately, you know, I'd rather just take care of the house and, you know, cook really nice dinners and go to the gym and whatever, do social work or something, volunteer at the library. Okay, so that's what the CBO's analysis says is driving the majority of this result. Is that, or I don't know if it's the majority, but that's the biggest component of it. Okay, so that's the idea, and so they're saying it's not that some people were working full-time jobs before and now they're working 0 hours, or there's 2 million of people like that. That's not what they're saying. They're saying a lot of people might just scale back their hours because they actually didn't want to be full-time workers. They would rather be part-time. So, but how do you quantify that? Well, they don't want to just report the gross number of hours. That doesn't mean a lot to people. That people think in terms of jobs. So they took the total number of hours and divided it by, and I don't know if they divided it by 30 or 35, because the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, they qualify a full-time equivalent as 35 hours, or that's what a full-time worker is by definition, someone who works 35 or more hours a week. So anyway, that was the result. So it's interesting because people are arguing about that. So of course, opponents of Obamacare are saying, see, Obamacare is destroying jobs just like we warned. Even the CBO agrees with us. But proponents of Obamacare, people like Paul Krugman and others, and the White House's own official response when this report came out, was to say, no, these are voluntary worker reductions in the quantity of labor supply. That these workers now have more options at their disposal, and so they're putting in fewer hours, and that's good. That they don't feel like they have to work just to get health insurance from their employer. Okay, and there, like I said, there's also, I'm just giving you one main example. There's all kinds of other incentive effects going on in there. For example, another big incentive effect is that if your income is low enough, you get subsidies from the government under Obamacare to help you buy your health insurance. And so let's say right now that you're not working or you're not working much, and so you have a really low income and you qualify for those subsidies. And now you have the opportunity to take a job that's going to give you more hours, right? So instead of either being unemployed or only working whatever 10 hours a week, now you have a chance to go up to 40 hours a week. But if you do that, your income is going to go up, obviously, and that's going to bring you out of the range of being eligible for the Obamacare subsidies. So when you consider all that, especially just the regular taxes, you realize that, wait a minute, I'm going to be working 30 extra hours a week. Before I was working 10, now I'm going to be working 40. And after taxes and after accounting for the fact that now I'm going to have to pay more out of pocket for health insurance because I won't be eligible for the subsidies anymore if I make more money, on the margin, I'm going to, for those 30 hours, you know, I'm going to get like $2 an hour more when all is said and done. That's crazy. I'm not going to bust my butt and only earn $2 an hour, all things considered. So, no, I'm just going to keep working 10 hours. Okay, so it's not merely correcting, as Krugman tries to frame it, the earlier thing where workers might have been working more than they wanted to because they needed to get health insurance from their employer. It also involves, you know, the CBO explicitly discusses this, the fact that by giving subsidies to low-income people to help them pay for their health insurance, the Affordable Care Act ironically penalizes people even more who are trying to rise up out of a low-income status. Because it by phasing out those subsidies, it's like the net return to you from working more goes way down. It's the similar analysis to if you were following the debate over extending unemployment benefits. Because the idea was if people lose their jobs, depending on the circumstances, they're eligible to get checks from the federal government, which was called my unemployment check. And the problem is, or one of the problems, is that the more generous those checks are, and the more they're tied to the person's employment status, then it weakens the incentive for the unemployed people to get new jobs. Okay, because, you know, if you just think about it, I'm just making up numbers here, but let's say you get laid off and you're getting checks from the government to pay you, I don't know what, $200 a week. And you will keep getting those checks for a while, but if you get hired, then the checks immediately stop. You know, if you tell the government, I'm no longer unemployed, I have a job, and they say, okay, well, then you don't need unemployment insurance anymore, or you don't need unemployment benefits anymore. So they stop sending you that. So even if your new job pays $400 a week after taxes, let's say it pays $500 a week after taxes. So that's pretty good, right? But on net, you're only actually getting $300 more a week from working, because if you did nothing, you would get $200 a week from the government. And so if you're going to work, yeah, you get that paycheck for $500 a week, but then you lose the $200 that the government was sending you in unemployment benefits. So on net, in exchange for you, instead of not going to work every day, sleeping in, doing whatever, now you got to get up in the morning and go to work every day. And at the end of the week, you only have $300 more than you otherwise would have had, at least while you're still getting the unemployment benefits or while you're still eligible. Okay, so that kind of shows the trade-offs and the incentive structure involved, and it shows the importance of thinking on the margin. That's partly why I'm going over this stuff, is it's so extremely relevant to the kind of stuff we're doing in an introductory class like this. Okay, looks like we've got some other people chiming in. Okay. Jed, where's your... I'm not seeing your question. Can you try pasting it again, Jed? Because I don't... Right, I'm looking in the chat box. I just see you saying... yes to me. I don't see. Okay, let me, while you guys are doing that, I guess I can talk a little bit about the taper, but like I say, go, if you guys can post stuff, it'll be easier. And I don't know if you're trying to, Jed, I'm not seeing anything on my end from you in terms of a question. So as far as the tapering goes, remember the, what was it, the third round of quantitative easing. And incidentally, the Federal Reserve, in its notes and everything, or its official policy announcements, it doesn't call these things QE1, QE2, or it doesn't even call them the first round of quantitative easing and then the second round. It doesn't, that's just, those are names that the financial press and analysts have dubbed for these various Fed announcements. You know, the Fed calls them more particular names. Probably because not too many people, well, I think most people who use phrases like QE are doing it disparagingly, but there actually are a lot of people who say, no, QE worked, keep doing it. But in any event, what people have called QE3, which is when it was sort of an open-ended purchase of bonds, let me discuss that for a second. The original quantitative easing announcement, so the first one was like in March of 2009, something like that. They gave very specific dollar amounts that they were going to, you know, they said, I don't remember off the top of my head what they were, but it was like, we're going to spend $700 billion on buying treasuries and mortgage-backed securities over the next such and such months, so long as economic conditions warrant, something like that. Right, so they gave a finite exit point for that particular probe, the scope of that announcement. And then with QE3, or what we've called QE3, they didn't give such a thing. They just said at the time, we're going to start buying monthly a total of $85 billion consisting of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. And these are new ones. Like these are going to be net additions to the Fed balance sheet. The stuff we already have on our balance sheet, as it matures, we're going to roll that over. So make sure you guys know that every month the Fed is actually going into the market and buying more than what you might think from descriptions of the program per month, because some of the stuff it already holds is maturing. You know, they're bonds, and so if they mature and you don't roll it over, well, then that means, you know, your balance sheet shrinks. Like somebody paid off the loan. Okay, so they're rolling that over. And then in addition, initially they were on net buying $85 billion more of bonds split between treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. Then the first taper move was in December, and they scaled it back. And then they just, like, I don't know, 10 days ago or so, scaled back again. And then we've seen recently that the stock market has been hurting since that. It fell more than 2% in a single day recently, which is a pretty big move. And so a lot of people are saying, okay, this is a clear connection that we've gotten to the point now where the Fed, even if it just slows the rate at which it's injecting new money into the credit markets and the banking system, the stock market begins to tank. And so that's kind of an awkward position. So remember, the tapering does not mean stop. It just means it's slowing the rate of purchase. And so that's kind of where we are right now. All right. Jed says, in the definition of individual income, it says can be spent on consumption goods. What if I can spend it on a capital good such as a lathe? Is consumption good the same as a consumer good? Is a lathe a consumer good if I use it for a hobby? I had to shorten the question. Okay, yeah, so all right, the easy one is, when you say, is a consumption good the same as a consumer good? Yeah, I was using those terms interchangeably. So that don't get hung up on that distinction. You're right. If you had a particular piece of equipment that most people would say, oh, that's a capital good or an investment good, a producer good, and those terms are all interchangeable in some respect. it could be a consumer good depending on how it's used. So normally you would think a hammer or let's say a power saw or something like that would be clearly, oh, those are tools. You know, those are things people use. They're not consumer goods in the same way that an ice cream cone is a consumer good. But you're right, it doesn't depend on the physical characteristics, it depends on how they're being used. So if for some reason there were a hammer, let's say it was a silver hammer, and I was a Beatles fan, I don't know if you know, but the Beatles have a song called Maxwell's Silver Hammer. And so what if I bought that, framed it on my wall, and put up one of the original Beatles albums that had Maxwell's Silver Hammer on it and put that next to it, so it was hanging on my wall, so it was a piece of art. So that would clearly be a consumer good, even though it's a hammer. Other people's minds, they might use that same physical thing as a capital good. However, that's not really the issue here, though, Jed, because what I was doing there, what you're grabbing that definition is for what income means, what's the definition of income in the context of an individual as opposed to the context of a business firm. And so we were saying how much that can be spent on consumption goods. What I'm trying to show you is that income means this is how much you can consume without going backwards in terms of your wealth. So I don't know if I make it clear. I'm trying to. Yeah, you could spend it on capital goods. That's saving, that's investment, right? So you're allowed to spend your income on things other than consumption. But what I'm trying to get at is when you're trying to define and say, what is my income? We're defining it by saying this is how much you could spend on consumption and still like stay even in terms of your overall wealth or your overall assets. Right. So if you just work through that prodigal Paul and frugal Freddie example, you know, the income is showing each period how much could you consume, how much could one of those brothers consume without changing the bank balance over the course of the period. So the person starts the next period with the same amount of assets that he started the previous period. And that is, by definition, what the person's income was in that period. Now, that's the definition. That's how you know what number it is, how big the income is. But then if you say, couldn't I spend the income on a capital good? Well, yeah, of course you could. And that just means you wouldn't be consuming the full amount of your income that period. It means you would be saving, because you'd be consuming less than your income. Okay, so income doesn't have to be spent on consumption goods, but my point is when we're defining or we're measuring how big is my income, it's like a thought experiment. We say, hypothetically, how much could you afford to spend on consumption right now in this period without reducing your wealth? And remember, if you end the period owing somebody money, and you didn't owe that person money in the beginning of the period, you reduced your wealth because now you've got a negative entry, as it were, against your other assets. Now you've got this outstanding liability. So it's your net wealth that I'm talking about. What are your total assets minus your total liabilities to outsiders? That's your net wealth. So over the course of a given period of time, like a year or 6 months or a week, whatever you want to define it as, I'm going to say, how much wealth did I start out with, how much net wealth? And then over the course of that period, what's the maximum amount I could consume if I wanted to, so that I end the period in the same position in terms of my net wealth? And that's, by definition, what your income is over the course of that period that you defined. So income is always defined over a duration of time, whereas your wealth is a snapshot. It's a stock concept, not a flow concept, if those terms mean anything to you. Okay, so I just And I apologize if you are, know all this. I'm kind of misunderstanding the thrust of your question, but I just want to make sure you understand, and the people who are hearing me talk about this, that even though the definition of income in the textbook has consumption in it, that doesn't mean you have to spend your income on consumption. It's just saying, well, we want to define what do we mean by this word income. Actually, the way you think about it in terms of the wealth you have, and then how much could you get away with consuming without digging yourself into a hole, so to speak. Okay, and then once you know that, then you can say, well, what would happen if over the course of that period of time I consumed less than that number we just discussed? Well, then in that case, you're living below your means. You're consuming less than your income, so you're saving. And then if you invest those savings wisely, you end up at the end of the period with a higher net wealth than you started out with. And vice versa, you could consume more than your income too. And that would just reduce your net wealth, either because you're borrowing, and so like that negative entry against your other assets is a bigger deal, a bigger offset, or that you're just selling off, drawing down your existing wealth. Okay. Steven says, in lesson 10, I understand how investment is more beneficial to the economy than consumption, but it seems there would be a limit or a balance. Doesn't some level of indulgement or consumption bring everyone better restaurants, entertainment, etc.? Hey, hang on, Steven. I see that Jed had a follow-up clarification, so let me just hit his point while we're still in the train of thought of what I was just talking about, and then I'll circle back, because yours is a totally different topic. Okay, so Jed says in follow-up, I guess my point is, why does it matter what I can spend it on for it to qualify as income? Okay, and I'm saying you might be misunderstanding what the definition is doing there. So again, it's because you could spend some, you have somebody gives you $100 because you painted their fence or something. So, the guy, the owner of the house, gives you $100. And I think you're saying, but wait a minute, what if I could go spend it on a drill press, wouldn't that, and that's a capital good, so now you're saying it's not income? And I'm saying, yeah, of course you could spend it on a capital good, but you could also spend it on consumption. So for it not to qualify as income would mean it would be impossible for you to spend it on a consumption good. See what I'm saying? So I can't tell if I'm helping or hurting, but I just want to be clear. In order to define it, what do we mean by income? We're saying, what's the most you could consume in a given period of time without hurting your wealth, without subtracting from your existing wealth? That's what we mean by definition of your income. And then you say, okay, do I have to spend that on consumption? No, of course not. Okay. Yeah, I see that, Jed. Jed clarified, said, yeah, I got it. My follow-up question got ahead of your answer. Yeah, that's fine. I figured that may have happened, but I just wanted to be clear. Let me, and I'm not directing this at you, Jed, but I just want to say something more generally to make sure we're getting this, because I realize for those of you who may not have missed, may not have caught it, or just if you missed the emphasis I put on it, of everything I did in Lessons for the Young Economist, I think defining income for this particular chapter was the most difficult, because the way PhD level economists, especially in the Austrian school, think about it, it's actually a really abstract concept. Okay, Hayek, in the one of his harder works, The Pure Theory of Capital, he spends a while defining what do we mean by income. And it gets really complicated. And so that was the problem I faced. Like, of course, I know what I think income is, and it's a crucial concept, but for people who might be in sixth grade reading Lessons from Leon Kahneman, which is to give an introduction to what do we mean by markets and how do markets work and stuff like that, and the person's never even held a job, let alone had a portfolio of assets, I was thinking, I don't want to really get into that kind of PhD level, high as hard as book level of discussion when there's obviously a much more intuitive everyday notion of what's income, what's the difference between income and consumption, what's the difference between income and saving, how are they related, how are income, saving, and investment related, right? So that was the stuff I want to talk about, to show if you live below your means by saving, then you can invest, and then you can raise your standard of living over time, raise your income over time, and so on. Those were the things I wanted to hit. But obviously, I needed to define income in the beginning before I could start talking about it. And so that's where I really struggled. And so I just want to just show you guys what some of the pitfalls are. Because it's not, you can't just say, oh, well, it's how much money you have coming in. No, that's not what income is. Because if I sell off my house for $200,000, and then I get $200,000 in cash, maybe I put it in my bank account. Okay, so I'm living in a house. I sell it for $200,000. The buyer gives me a check. I put it in my checking account. So now I have $200,000 in my checking account. That's not income. That's not the same as if I worked for somebody all year and got a salary of $200,000, and the $200,000 in my bank account is because I was working and earned the $200,000 that way, as opposed to I sold off my house. Okay, those are different. Those are two ways of getting $200,000 more into my checking account, but only one of them is income, because when I sold the house, what happened? Yeah, I got $200,000 more in my checking account, so my cash balances went up by $200,000, but my quantity of houses went down by one. I started the period with a nice house, and I ended the period with no house. Right? So it would be a mistake to treat that $200,000 as income free and clear that I could go spend on pizza and parties and go into an amusement park and not think that I just made myself poorer. Everyone see that? In contrast, if I go work for someone and sell my labor services and get $200,000, and then I go spend all of that money on entertainment and having a good time, and I have nothing to show for it when all is said and done except the memories of how fun it was, I haven't set myself back any in an absolute sense. You see that? I didn't give up any other asset. It's just I sold my labor services and then just consumed the proceeds, and I didn't do anything productive and long term with it. You see that distinction? So that's why I'm trying to get see. I thought it was too simplistic just to say your income is the money you have coming in that you can spend on stuff, because it depends how are you getting that money. Let me give you one more example. Okay, watch this. Okay, so this is office hours, so I'm going off in tangents here. I'm not going to quiz you at this level of difficulty if you're taking a course for credit. I'm trying to get you guys to see why this stuff gets subtle and why I really had to tread carefully when defining this concept, in case you're thinking, what the heck? Everyone knows what income is. You're overthinking it, Murphy. No, I'm not, because you're underthinking it if you think that this is a really easy concept to define. Because watch this. I hope I just convinced you, if you sell a house for $200,000, it would be a mistake to count that $200,000 as income. But watch this. What if you're a savvy real estate speculator and you see a house that's on the market for $180,000? And you know that the people living there, let's say the guy got a new job offer, and he's got to leave immediately, right? That his new job is in a different state, and they want him to start work immediately. So he leaves, and he's living in an apartment in another state, and he never sees his wife. And so they want to sell that house as fast as possible so that she can go move to the other state and be with him, and then they can buy a new house out there and they get settled. Okay, so they drop the price. They want to just sell that thing to move. They just want to get out of there fast. They don't want to have the house on the market for 6 months while they find the right buyer. They just want to get rid of it. So they put the house on the market for $180,000, and the savvy real estate speculator sees that. He says, I could sell that with a month of marketing for $200,000. That's easy. So he swoops in, gives them a cash offer because he's got all kinds of liquid assets. He buys their house for $180,000 on January 1st, or let's say February 1st, because it's on a holiday, New Year's. So he buys it on February 1st for $180,000. Then he puts it on the market, and a month later, he sells it for $200,000. Okay, so now we've got a similar scenario to what we talked about a few minutes ago. This real estate speculator sold a house and has $200,000 coming in. And now I'm going to say some of that is income. $20,000 of it is. You see that? In the course of that month, that real estate speculator earned $20,000 in income from his speculative services. Or, you could technically, in terms of the tax code and economic treatment, it would be called a capital gain. But he bought an asset for $180,000 and then sold it for $200,000 a month later. So that 10%, well, no, it was more than a 10% rate of return. $180,000 was invested. So that wasn't just interest income, right? If he bought a bond for $180,000 and then let it mature for a month, he wouldn't earn 10% or even more than 10%. He wouldn't earn $20,000 for keeping that $180,000 rolling over for a month. So there's clearly a gain there above and beyond just interest income on his invested assets, right? So my point is that's income. The way to think about it is he started the period with $180,000 in cash in no house. He bought the house, the month went by, he sold the house, and he ended up with $200,000 in cash and no house. Okay, so if you look at the moment right before he bought the house and the moment right after he sold the house, and that's about a month duration, he went from having $180,000 to having $200,000 in his bank account in dollars. And so he made himself wealthier. And so that's how you can see, so he must have had income in that period, because that was how he was able to raise his assets. Now, if during that same period he went out and had parties and stuff and threw all kinds of great parties and spent $20,000 on them, well, then he would have consumed the income during that period. And his bank account would have ended up the same, because the stuff with the house made it go up $20,000, but then him having all those parties made it go down $20,000. And so when all is said and done, he's back to where he was. And the way you would explain what happened was to say he earned an income through a speculative real estate transaction of $20,000 during that month, but he also consumed $20,000 worth of wild parties and whatever he did with it by spending the $20,000 on fun stuff. So his income and consumption happened to be the same. Okay, so you see how complicated this stuff gets in the interaction between your assets and your income and your consumption and so forth. But what I'm trying to get you to see is it's actually really difficult to define income so that it was true and was acknowledging a lot of these subtleties that I'm bringing up with you guys, but yet wasn't so complicated that only Friedrich Hayek could understand it. Let me throw you one last curveball, you guys, and I'll turn back to the questions you guys have posted here. The other thing is, you remember before when I said if you sell a house for $200,000 and that money comes in, it would be wrong to count the full $200,000 as your income, because you got to take into account the fact that you just lost the house, that or the ownership of houses you have just went down by one. Well, by the same token, if you sell your labor services to someone and get $200,000, strictly speaking, you might want to say, does that reduce my body's ability to produce similar labor services in the future? Okay, and that you technically might want to take that into account. Perhaps a different way of looking at it, or a more contrived example, though, that really hits home at what I'm talking about is, here's a good one. So, what was it? There was some spy novel, some thriller that was made into a movie, and now I can't remember what the name of the movie was, but maybe some of you saw it. It was probably like 20 years ago. But anyway, the hitman gets hired to try to kill the president's wife. In this fictional movie. So the guy is an assassin. He's an international assassin, the Interpol and the CIA. These people all know who this guy is. And some client approaches him and says, we want to hire you to kill the wife of the president of the United States. And so he says to this person, okay, let's consider this. I'm willing to consider the job, but the compensation will have to reflect the fact that if I do this, I can never work again. Because he's saying if you go after a target of that level, he's going to be really wanted, and so he's just going to have to go into hiding for the rest of his life. He can't really do anything. So his point was, the amount he would have been paid there would have to reflect not just the labor services he was providing, but the fact that he was effectively destroying his ability to earn income going forward. Okay, so I'm picking that example in case you saw that movie to make it more interesting to some of you, perhaps, than if I had picked some real boring example, like a guy working in a coal mine and hurting his body. Okay, so that's, you see, this is kind of, when we think of labor earning a pure income, it's because we're thinking that the act of you selling your labor services doesn't impair your ability to sell labor services in the future. But strictly speaking, if you take a job in order to get money, in the course of you performing that job, you make it so that your ability to earn income in the future gets diminished, then you shouldn't count all of that money as pure income. Some of it reflects the fact that your wealth has gone down by you taking that job. Okay, back to your guys' questions. So Steven says, let me just repeat this. In lesson 10, I understand how investment is more beneficial to the economy than consumption is, but it seems there would be also a limit or a balance. Doesn't some level of indulgence or consumption bring everyone better restaurants, entertainment, etc.? I think I see what you're saying, Stephen. Let me just paraphrase and make sure. So Stephen, I will paraphrase what I think you're saying and then answer that. But if in so doing I've changed the meaning of what you're trying to ask me, then clarify, okay? So I think what you're saying is, yeah, I get how if a household could go out to it could buy a fancy new sports car, and that's pretty much pure consumption, or it could save, and then if it gives it to a financial institution, and then that institution lends it to some factory, and the factory then spends money on research and development, that's obviously investment. And so in terms of, from the economy-wide perspective, isn't our future standard of living for everybody, not just for that household, probably going to be higher if the household saves, and then those resources ultimately get channeled into investment expenditures rather than engaging in consumption. Okay. And I think what you're saying is, but wait a minute, what if the household, in terms of its consumption, buys some experimental new sports car, and that the firm that makes these sports cars, or maybe like they're space tourists. So they, these rich guys that are spending like $10 million to the SpaceX companies or whatever, and they're spending $10 million to be taken up into low Earth orbit. just for purely recreational reasons, right? It's not because they want to fund science or anything. They just want to be able to go up and see Earth from outer space. Like, that's the coolest thing ever. Who wouldn't want to do that? If you're a billionaire, yeah, of course you'd spend $10 million for that. But then in so doing, isn't their consumption actually allowing a lot of these companies to engage in research and development? Aren't they? Because these companies are trying to figure out how can we provide a service to shuttle people up into space just for the tourism aspect, isn't that effectively the same as investment expenditures? So for sure, Mises endorses that line of analysis, Stephen, in the sense he's saying that there's like a certain social function to luxury expenditures, and saying that's something that the rich do. That the things that the rich class, who may be real snobs and elitist in terms of their social cliques and what have you, but a function they actually provide for everybody is they are early adopters. And you know, Mises might not use these terms, obviously, but I'm paraphrasing. But yeah, they're early adopters. They spend money on stuff so that things that were luxuries to the rich a generation ago are now considered necessities for the masses today. So at one point, you know, to have a mobile phone, that was like a real esoteric thing that only rich people did. And it was like a novelty. But now everybody has a cell phone. It's nothing. Or to have air conditioning in your car. At one point, that was something that only rich people would spend extra on. Whereas now, you know, it's considered unbearable if you don't have air conditioning in your car. That's just a standard feature. So if that's what you're getting at, then yes, that's exactly true. And other Austrian writers have talked about that very phenomenon. I'm trying to. It's interesting, Stephen, to break it down and to say, well, so then wait a minute though. What about this dichotomy between consumption and investment? How does that actually work? How do you classify stuff? Like if the rich person is spending $10 million to go into space, is that $10 million consumption or investment? From whenever you get mixed up with stuff like that, just do it from the individual's subjective point of view. So if the rich person is spending $10 million purely because, no, I'm going to get a certain amount of happiness out of that. It's going to be a thrill to get launched up there and look out, and that's why the person's doing it. That's a consumption expenditure. But the ability of that consumption expenditure may lead, in order to get ready for that, the companies may get funding from elsewhere. You see what I'm saying? Like, they're going to get ready for the fact that they know that these rich people are going to be plopping down money. So there's that issue also. And then from the company's point of view, they might be engaging in investment expenditures in order to get ready to provide that. And then the last curveball I'll offer is, if part of why the rich person is spending $10 million is that he or she is aware of the fact that just by doing that, it will promote research and engineering breakthroughs and scientific discovery that will promote humanity's ability down the road to colonize the solar system or whatever, then that could also be partly an investment. Okay, so there was the person who endowed the X Prize that Spaceship One won, you know, somebody put up, I don't remember how much it was like $10 million or something, maybe somebody in the comments knows. But a few years ago, some rich person put up a bunch of money, a bounty to say the first person or the first group that can have a privately funded spacecraft get up into orbit, and it had a bunch of criteria for what it had to do, will get this big dollar amount from me. So clearly that person was just trying to provide incentives to promote the development of space travel. So that was, you know, that wasn't consumption spending necessarily, or it was philanthropy. Depends how you want to define it. Okay, Jed says, when you say a worker's pay is based on his marginal productivity, does that mean on a net basis after expenses and return to the employer? Yes, but everything's got to be done on a marginal basis. Okay, so what you're saying is, if I hire this extra worker, how much are the firm's revenues going to go up because now he's been incorporated into the mix? And when you're saying, do you mean net of expenses? Yeah, well, yeah, but only if the expenses went up because you hired the worker. See what I'm saying? So if you would have been spending $1,000, you own the business. If you would have been spending $1,000 on the electric bill each month anyway, and you're thinking about hiring another waiter, let's say it's a diner, and you every month you spend $1,000 on your electricity bill, and right now you have four waiters and you're trying to figure out, does it make sense to hire a fifth waiter? If your electric bill is going to be $1,000 either way, then bringing that fifth waiter on won't change how much electricity your business uses during the course of the month. Then that $1,000 utility bill has nothing to do with that waiter's marginal productivity and his wage rate. So what you want to, but if hiring that extra waiter means now you serve more meals during the course of the month, and so you go through more food, well then yeah, you don't just look at how much more your revenue went up. You also look at, well, how much more did I spend on, you know, the hamburger patties and stuff that we get from our food suppliers. So if your expenses are higher because you're doing more business, because you hired that extra waiter, then yeah, you want to take that into account. So you're just, what you're really saying is, how much is my profit going up, not counting that worker's wages because I hired him? And then that's theoretically how much you ought to be willing to pay. You don't want to pay that much because otherwise you don't gain. But the point is, if by hiring that worker, my total profit as the business goes up by $2,000 per month, then I should be willing to pay up to $2,000 per month to hire that worker. Because if I pay him anything less than that, I gain. I make more profit because of my decision to hire that worker. So when you're calculating how much does my profit go up by hiring this worker, yeah, you gotta consider revenue and expenses, but just like I say, be careful. The real issue is, by bringing that worker into the mix, how much do my expenses go up? It doesn't matter what your expenses were before, because that's not the worker's fault. Okay, Steven says, in other words, the part about diverting income from consumption to investment makes sense, but seems a little like eco-hominist thinking. Okay, and then he says again, it seems like someone has to be a consumer. I think, Steven, you have a bunch of different ideas floating around in the comments you're making. And I know Steven clarified it. No, you already answered it. I know, but I think you're also bringing up another issue here. So I just want to talk about that for a second. And then, Kay, I'll hit your question, and then that's where we'll stop. What is certainly true, and I want to be clear. I said this in the lecture from last week, I believe. Let me say it again, or at least in the office hours, I can't remember. I am not saying that economically speaking, more investment is better than consumption, right? Because that's like saying that it's better for there to be more red cars rather than blue cars. Okay, what we can say as economists is that there's a trade-off, and if people are willing to reduce consumption in the present, it frees up resources that can be diverted to the production of capital goods that raises our income down the road. which allows either for more investment or more consumption. Okay, but we as economists can't make a value judgment and say what do people prefer. That's based on subjective preferences of consumers. We can say things like that the IRS tax code shouldn't put an artificial penalty on saving, and that if there is an artificial penalty on saving right now, which there is, that will tend to make people save less than the economically efficient amount. And so in that sense, we can say there ought to be more saving from an economics perspective. But there, it's not because economics tells us more saving is always better. It's because we're saying, as economists, we can recognize the distortions that the government tax code is introducing, and it's causing people to save less than they would in a free market. And that's the criterion by which we're saying right now there's too little saving. All right. What you're also bringing up, though, Stephen, is one way of seeing how it can't be true to say people should always save and invest more, that's always better, is that in the limit, if all people ever did was save and invest and never consumed, well, then what the heck is the point? Right? The point of saving and investing is to raise your future income so that your consumption in the future can be higher than it would be able to be if you didn't do that, right? So with Prodigal Paul and Frugal Freddy, the moral there was not, oh, you can build up your assets if you're willing to not consume or consume less. The point was, if you consume less, yeah, you build up your assets, but after a while, depending on the numbers, your income is so much higher that you can actually consume more and save more and have a bunch of assets. Okay, so it was only a short-term trade-off. In the long term, people who save more actually get to consume more also. Okay, so I don't know if that's partly what you're getting at, that that's why it would be, to have this single-minded focus on saving and investment would be ridiculous. It would be missing the point. The reason you save is so that you can consume more in the future. It's not because you're anti-consumption per se. Okay, let me just answer Kay's question really fast and then I'll stop. Kay says, so does taxation essentially sidetrack funds from both savings and investment? If so, how is there any economic advancement possible at all, other than for war, social programs, et cetera, when the income tax was approximately 80%? Okay, a lot of things wrapped up into that, Kay, but good questions. So, yeah, the first one, if the government is taxing us and taking those funds and then spending it on stuff, what we can say, I mean, there is from like a libertarian perspective, of course, you can classify that as aggression and say that's wrong and immoral. So that's certainly true. But just in terms of value-free, neutral economic analysis, we can also say that the government institutionally is not going to spend that money as wisely as people in the private sector would, because they don't have the right information. They don't know what people's preferences are and what they really want, for one thing, and they don't have the incentive to try to make those people happy, even if they did. Okay, and then there's also the Ludwig von Mises, what's called the calculation problem, which I don't, certainly we can't get into right now because I'm already over time. All right, but so there's a knowledge problem, an incentive problem, and a calculation problem that are all related, but they're actually distinct things that the Austrians talk about that explain why even just economically having a household spend $1,000 is going to give that household more satisfaction than taking $1,000 and giving it to bureaucrats and saying, you spend it on the household's behalf. Okay, so in that respect, yes, Kay, you're exactly right. When the government taxes and spends, we get less consumption and investment, measured in a certain objective metric. Okay, last thing Kay says, she's alluding to the fact that there were periods, it wasn't even just 80%, Kay, I mean, there were periods where the U.S. top federal income tax was like over 90%. And in World War II, it was really high. And in Britain, it was, what was the Beatles song? You know, the one for you, 19 for me. Okay, so I mean, that wasn't, George Harrison wasn't just inventing those proportions. That really was what the income tax, the top rate was. Okay, so what happened in there, there's a couple things. So one is there were a lot of exemptions and so forth, Kay, right? So I don't think a lot of people actually were structuring their wealth to pay those taxes. And that's the example of Great Britain. Apparently that's what the Rolling Stones did, that they started living abroad because then they weren't, their earnings from their music wasn't subject to that punitive tax. I think it's a similar thing in the United States. You invested in certain assets that was not, that income was not getting hit with that top marginal rate. But I mean, another thing too was, it depends where that rate kicked in, right? That what if you had one tax code that was just like a 20% flat tax, and another tax code that was a 10% tax on any income up to $1 billion a year, but if you made $1 billion a year or more, then you got hit with a 50% tax. And if you ask which tax code is more distortionary, you know, arguably the first one is, right? Because the second one, yeah, the top marginal rate is higher, but it only kicks in at $1 billion. And most people don't earn anywhere near that. And so their decisions aren't going to be affected by that hypothetical top rate. Okay, so there's a similar thing too with when you're looking at these historical tax rates at various levels of income, you would want to adjust it to see, you know, how many households actually were getting hit with that thing. So that's another just calculation. That doesn't erase it, but I'm just saying that's one adjustment you would want to make. But having said all that, Kay, yeah, I think it does distort it. And I think what happens is people say, well, see, 1950s and 60s, there was a lot of, you know, the U.S. economy was really strong, even though they had these really high marginal tax rates. So clearly marginal tax rates don't impede work effort or investment, like these crazy Austrians or the supply side Chicago school guys say. And you got to be careful. One thing, let me just make two more points and I'll stop and go over with you guys. One thing is, precisely because the tax rates were so punitive, that may have made businesses keep their money invested. And so if you're just rolling over the earnings in an asset and not selling it and realizing the gains, then it may not have been taxed. You see what I'm saying? So I don't know. I'd have to go look at the vagaries of the tax code. But I'm just saying, like, if there's – you buy some stock at $100, and so then the stock price is going up year after year, and there's a certain tax rate that's applied. If, as long as you don't sell the stock and realize your capital gain, you don't get hit with the tax. So on paper, you could be saying, yeah, I'm earning all this income, but you only settle up with the IRS once you actually sell the asset, and then you can say, okay, I bought in at this amount, I sold this amount, the difference is my gain. And then I owe the tax rate times that gain, and that's my tax bill. So that's partly why when they tinker with the capital gains tax rate, you see a really big change in behavior. Okay, so there's that issue that in the 50s and 60s, the U.S. partly, there could have been a lot of investment and growth just because businesses were reinvesting or whatever, because then the owners didn't want to take the money out and get hit with those tax rates. And the other thing is they were coming off of World War II. And so the federal government was the most nationalized it's been in U.S. history in World War II. And then they drastically cut back what they were doing. So other things equal, of course, the period after that would have seen a huge increase in the private sector. And so what I'm saying is it's entirely possible that, yeah, those marginal tax rates were punitive, but it's just – The baseline would have been so awesome that even with those tax rates, it's still okay. Okay, let's stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in, and I will get those YouTubes of Lecture 5 posted as soon as I can.